Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the man who brought transcendental meditation to the West, died on Tuesday at his late life home in the Netherlands. He was said to be 91. His teachings on meditation began to sweep the United States in the 1960s when many Americans took their courses and got their mantras. The Beach Boys' Mike Love and Mia Farrow tried it, and famously, the Beatles. 40 years on, millions of Americans have dabbled, or much more, with an Eastern way to peace and health. This hour on Point, we're talking about the death of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and America's love affair with Eastern spirituality, from TM to yoga. With us today from DeForest, Wisconsin, is Jeff Gilpin. He's author of a memoir, The Maharishi Effect. He has a long history with the Maharishi and transcendental meditation, joined the movement in the 1960s. After a couple of pauses, he's still practicing today. Jeff, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
And with us from Berkeley, California, is Mark Juergensmeyer. He's professor of sociology, religious studies. He's the director of the Center for Global and International Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He was a professor at Berkeley during the heyday of the TM movement. Professor Juergensmeyer, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Jeff Gilpin, first, take us back. Remind us what it was like. What you first thought of this when you first heard of transcendental meditation, how out of the ordinary it seemed in the 60s, even into the 70s for a while.
Well, you know, it is hard to recall back then, but when Maharishi appeared in the United States, meditation was pretty much unknown. I think that for a lot of people, the idea of sitting in a chair with your eyes closed for 20 minutes doing nothing would have just seemed un-American. And it's a tribute to Maharishi's marketing savvy and success that he not only made meditation acceptable, he made it popular.
Let's listen for a moment to, here's the Maharishi in 1969 talking to the BBC. He had said at first that he thought he had to renounce the world to become a truly spiritual man, a yogi, but then he discovered something else.
What I found out is that this spiritual life is not dependent on the renunciation of the world. It's only dependent on morning and evening practice of meditation, which can take our mind to the inner being and open to us the great reservoir of intelligence and energy and bliss consciousness.
Intelligence and energy and bliss consciousness. Who wouldn't be attracted to all that? Jeff, do you remember when you first ran across it, or what got you to pick it up?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was part of that generation of young people who was very interested in Eastern spirituality and really wanted to learn meditation. And, you know, back then, TM and Maharishi were pretty much the only game in town. I saw a poster advertising a TM lecture. I went and I learned it, and the initial experience was just wonderful, and I've been doing it ever since.
Of course, a lot of people became aware of all this with the Beatles. They went off, it was supposed to be, for 3 months to hang out at the ashram in India and learn their meditation. Here's Paul McCartney talking about the Beatles' time in Rishikesh, India, and about one special opportunity with the Maharishi that John Lennon immediately seized.
Somehow, a helicopter came. It landed down by the Ganges. This was on the banks of the Ganges in Rishikesh. And it was like, one of you can go up for a quick ride with Maharishi. Who's going to be? Me, sir. And of course, it was John. John always would, he was good at that, you know. So it got to be him anyway. And I was saying, why were you so keen, like, to get up with Maharishi? He said, tell you the truth. He said, I thought you might slip me the answer. It's very John.
The answer Paul McCartney was looking for, and a whole lot of other people. Mark Juergensmeyer in Berkeley, California. We're going to hear more from Jeff, but take us back to that moment when all of this, you know, talk about mantras and meditation and everything else still seemed so foreign to most Americans.
Yeah, it was a euphoric moment, and of course, the euphoria sometimes came through a slightly smoky haze.
Yes.
Because it was a part of a general youth culture. You know, this was, after all, the first significant cultural movement after the war, the baby boomer generation, people discovering themselves. And in a sense, it's a part of the globalization of Eastern religion, but in another sense, it's a very, very American phenomenon, this searching out for something individualistic, something that would enhance me, you know, give a kind of personal transformation in a way that was rather simple, could be done easily, didn't require a lot of the difficult discipline of, or, you know, traditional religions. It was a very American youth kind of thing.
The Maharishi popularized this enormously, but it wasn't as though no Americans had ever looked east before. I mean, you go back to the 50s and the Beats, even all the way back to the Transcendentalist movement, there was attention paid.
Sure, there were several great moments in American history. You talked about Emerson and the Transcendentalists, Thoreau, and of course in the World Parliament of Religions at the end of the 19th century was another great boom of American interest in Eastern religiosity. The Theosophy movement, you know, began in San Diego. So there's a whole tradition of Americans having this curiosity about Eastern things, and I think in every case it's genuinely American. There's this kind of quest for something special, something different that could be appropriated by individuals and doesn't need all of the trappings and claptrap of a huge traditional orthodoxy.
And when you look out on American culture today, just begin to enumerate for us the ways in which this kind of Eastern vein of spirituality shows up now. I mean, I know neighborhoods where it seems like every corner has a yoga studio these days, but there's so many manifestations now.
Yeah, you know, in the Episcopal Church that I attend, they were talking about redoing the sanctuary so they could have yoga classes there on Friday night. And this was said without the slightest trace of irony or paradox. It's just sort of a normal thing to do in an Episcopalian church. So, I mean, there's a kind of – it's just like there were a few coffee houses in the 60s and 70s in Berkeley, and now there's Starbucks everywhere. You know, there's been a kind of franchise character of yoga and this style of religiosity that at the same time that it's intensely personal does have a social connection to it. You feel like you're part of a group, but more part of an organization than a community. There's something really very modern about this ancient method.
Mm. Shirley MacLaine picked it up in Mia Farrow and football star Joe Namath and pop singer Donovan, and pretty soon it was everywhere. Here's a 1969 interview with the BBC that Maharishi is speaking with Leslie Smith.
Here in Transcendental Meditation, the mind becomes sharper and sharper as it experiences the final state of thought, and by the time it explores the source of thought, it gains bliss consciousness.
What has the word transcendental got to do with it?
Transcendental means the mind goes from one experience to the other experience of thinking. It transcends the experience of thought on one level, gets to the other finer state of thought, and thereby it is transcending the field of thought. That's why we call it transcendental meditation.
The finer state of thought, bliss consciousness. Jeff Gilpin, did you get there? Are you there right now?
Well, you know, I still experience some of that bliss morning and evening when I practice transcendental meditation for 20 minutes twice a day. It's really a very nice thing that's influenced my life in very profound ways.
Have you been doing it ever since, I don't know when, the early 70s then?
Yeah, I learned in 1973 in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and I've done it twice a day for 35 years now.
I remember when everybody was getting their mantra, this was a secret Sanskrit word that they would recite. Was that a big deal for you?
The mantra is really key to meditation, and it's a traditional Indian technique that people in India have been doing basically forever. And Maharishi's genius was to package that and make it popular in the West. And it was even called jokingly the McDonald's of meditation at the time, or McMantra, because it was like a fast food franchise. It was everywhere.
Transcendental meditation claims 5 million practitioners in 130 countries, but really the TM movement in particular at this point is just kind of a part of the continent of spirituality and practice that has flowed this way since then, isn't it, Jeff?
Well, certainly Maharishi started something very big. I think that TM, a lot of people who learned TM back then, went on to do other things. They became part of the human potential movement of the 70s, the new age movement of the 80s and 90s that's still with us now. And so his influence really, really fanned out into the culture.
I want to hear about the bigger experience. I mean, you were there in Iowa at the Maharishi University, I think. You were really in the heart of the institutional expression of this in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was kind of in the thick of the TM movement for 5 years in the mid-70s at the peak of Maharishi's success. It was an amazing time.
Fairfield, Iowa, Maharishi University, and its attendees are a pretty substantial portion of the population in that town of Iowa.
I think it's about half of the people in town now practice TM. And of course, when we arrived there in the 70s, it was really a contrast. You know, there were people coming in from the Movement Center, which had been in California at the time, arriving in this little Norman Rockwell-esque town in the middle of nowhere. So it was a real cultural contrast at the time. But, you know, now the movement has really integrated itself into the culture there, and it's an amazing place.
I know the ways of heaven, the farther one travels, the less one knows.
I'm Tom Asper. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the death of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and America's love affair with Eastern spirituality and meditation, from transcendental meditation to yoga. We've been joined from DeForest, Wisconsin, by Jeff Gilpin, author of The Maharishi Effect, A Personal Journey Through the Movement That Transformed American Spirituality. He attended Maharishi University in Fairfield, Iowa, joined the TM movement in the 1960s. From Berkeley, California, we're joined by Mark Juergensmeyer, director of the Center for Global and International Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's author of Global Religion, Gandhi's Way, and Terror in the Mind of God. I want to go to Jenna in Lincolnville, Maine. Hi, Jenna. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello. What do you think? What do you know?
Well, I'm a Gen Xer, which means I was born in 1969, which means that my mother was, you know, youthful in the 60s. And I came home from school one day when I was 14, which was 1983, and my mother was sitting on the living room floor chanting Nam-myoho Renge-kyo. And my mother had always been like a nice Jewish girl, not particularly practicing Jewish, but, you know, not a groovy by any means.
Okay.
But I think, you know, she started chanting, it was Nichiren Buddhism, which is more from Japan than India.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like she would not have been so open to that if there hadn't been all that contact with the more Indian forms of spirituality in the 60s. And she kept practicing like I practice. We've all been Buddhist for 23 years. And that, too, I feel like the Buddhist movement, the Japanese Buddhist movements, probably wouldn't have gotten as much of a toehold in America as they did because of the Maharishi.
And it's come on down to you, even though it sort of jumped rails from one tradition to another. I'm hearing a kind of gratitude for the guy who got introduced here or popularized here, Jenna.
Yeah. And hey, man, I grew up with those Beatles records, and I loved them. I know, I mean, I didn't just love the music. I felt that there was something being said there that I resonated with. And I have gratitude for that, too.
And it still lives in your life. Thanks very much for calling in, Jenna. Mark Juergensmeyer, here's just one example, but of how a whole, you know, hemisphere of spirituality has kind of become mainstream.
Yeah, kind of come mainstream in a very interesting way, because she talked about Nichiren Buddhism, mm-hmm, in Japan, and this certain kind of Hinduism from India that the Maharishi taught, both of which are, in their own way, kind of marginal to the religious culture of their own traditions, mm-hmm, of India and Japan. So what we're getting is kind of an export religiosity, a kind of global religion that really isn't deeply rooted, at least in this form, in the traditions from which it comes. I mean, the Maharishi, for example, couldn't really become established in India because he wasn't a Brahmin. He came from a business class. He, mm-hmm, was, you know, got a graduate degree in physics. He was not really a traditional holy man in the Indian sense. So he made it by what Professor Gilpin called a kind of marketing of Hinduism, a kind of globalization of Hinduism, a simple individualistic form that it was accessible around the world in a way that really wasn't typical in India itself. So it's a new phenomenon, this new kind of religiosity that the franchising of religion made for a transnational culture. It's, you know, it's something like the ancient Mediterranean world where Judaism could not have made it on its own. So Christianity, which was like the exportable form of Judaism, the global Judaism, just goes crazy in the Mediterranean world because it could appeal to individuals. And this is the kind of religiosity in the global age. It's a new kind of global religion.
Jeff Gilpin, is that the way you've experienced it? Have you seen yourself as tapped into really a traditional spirituality here or something more globalized, kind of streamlined to travel?
Well, I'm pretty much spiritually eclectic. I've taken Maharishi's teachings and then all sorts of other things. But, you know, it's true that he really did open the floodgates. I remember back when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, you know, if you were religious or spiritual in the United States, you could be Protestant or you could be Catholic or you could be Jewish, and that was pretty much it. And once Maharishi opened the door, people discovered meditation and took it off in a million different ways, and not just yoga and Buddhism and so forth. I had friends in the TM movement who then went on to explore Orthodox Judaism, various forms of Christianity, and we're never going to go back to the way it was in the 50s and 60s. And I think really Maharishi is as responsible for that, for better or for worse, as anybody.
Let's go to Doug in Franklin, Massachusetts. Hi, Doug. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hello to your guests. I just called with a quick comment and observation. I attended the Beach Boys concert in Hartford, Connecticut, where the Maharishi accompanied them back in 1968.
Wow, what a picture.
Yeah, and I remember Mike Love coming on stage and asking the audience to be still and show some respect, and the curtain opened, and the Maharishi was sitting there. I don't remember too much. I remember him. He sat with a long-stem purple flower.
And, Doug, do us a favor. Paint a picture of him, because he was quite a visual spectacle in his long, flowing heyday.
Yeah, he had the long, flowing hair, then the beard. He was sitting on he was dressed in white robes. He was sitting on a saffron-colored pillow, as I remember, perhaps on a small platform, you know, underneath it.
And Mike Love of the Beach Boys had maybe already been to his ashram in India at that point.
Yeah, we had known that. He didn't talk too much about his experience. He's let the Maharishi do most of the speaking after he introduced him. What I remember is the Maharishi, he sat for probably, what seemed to me at 18, probably 3 or 4 minutes, an interminably long time.
right.
And then he said, contemplate the flower. And again, I was 18.
Yeah.
I'd really come to hear the music. But I sat through the whole presentation. However, during it, his reception by the audience was probably fairly rude. Most of the audience walked out on him. And, again, this is in Hartford, Connecticut.
You wanted to hear Surfing USA.
They wanted to hear Surfing USA or perhaps just a short intermission on the Transcendental Meditation. But he continued to talk. He had a very high pitched voices, I remember, almost
yes.
Girlish.
We've heard that today already, yeah.
Yeah, and probably by, after, I'm going to say probably 45 minutes, there was probably fewer than 50 people in the auditorium, and I believe the tour was pulled after that appearance in Hartford.
Oh, boy. Doug, we appreciate your taking us back, painting the mural of what that was like in 1968, that's just great. Jeff Gilpin, not everybody was drawn in those early days. Contemplate the flower and sit quietly didn't automatically compete with Beach Boys rock and roll.
No, and, you know, that's not really the way you present meditation to a rock concert audience. Maharishi may have been a marketing genius in some ways, but he sure had his misfires. And I wasn't there at that show. I've heard about it. And one of the rumors that I've always heard was that that experience was part of what soured Maharishi on the counterculture. And certainly after that, he really wanted to go for the mainstream American image. He wanted suits and ties. He didn't want any of the hippie stuff after that.
Mm. Here he is in a 1969 interview, again with the BBC, talking about a potential connection between transcendental meditation and prayer for an individual.
Because of increased capacity of the mind, every thought of his will be more powerful, and then his prayers will naturally be more powerful. So this is not a method of prayer, but if one wants to pray after meditation, he will pray better. If you want to write an essay after meditation, fine, he'll write very creative essays.
There, the Maharishi in 1969. Let's go to Mike in Malone, New York. Hi, Mike, you're on the air.
Hi. I grew up in the 60s, and I was enamored with the Beatles and fascinated with their Eastern spirituality direction, especially George Harrison's. But, you know, when the Beatles manager, Brian Epstein, died, they sort of looked to him for that guidance, and they became disillusioned for several reasons, and he was discredited, but I do
Paul
want
Paul McCartney to said, we made a mistake. We thought there was more to him than there was. He's human. We thought at first that he wasn't.
Well, Lennon was more, you know, servant than that. He wrote Sexy Sadie, which is exactly the Maharishi, the same number of syllables, and changed it to Sexy Sadie on the What Beatles White album. And that's quite a scathing, you know, indictment of the spiritual guru. But I must say, I need to, you know, give credit where it's due in so far as my attraction to Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, and, you know, like you say, the flood that came from the East, and insofar as, and the greatest of all people, the Dalai Lama, as far as I'm concerned. Now that has affected my life dramatically, too.
Do you think it's changed American culture at some level, Mike? It's America's.
Yes, I do. I really believe that, you know, Buddhism has, you know, taken root here. It's still small, but it's not going to go away.
Even for people who aren't Buddhists? Has it kind of infiltrated the wider...
The yoga thing has become very ubiquitous in terms of Christian yoga and you know, it's secularizing it as well. So.
Yeah, and we see it all over. Mike, thanks for that. Let's get a call from Barney in Stamford, Connecticut. Hi, Barney, you're on the air.
Okay, it's actually Bernie.
Bernie, excuse me. Yeah, hi.
And welcome back. It's the first time I'm talking to you since you returned to the air.
Great to have you. Great to be here.
Okay, my little experience, well, I had a family of two or three children at the time. We started going to the TM Center near us, and I either did not correctly hear or soon after forgot my mantra. And they wouldn't repeat it for me, and they wouldn't give me a new one. So this totally turned me off, and I personally no longer believed in it. We did go back to the center, which was in Darien.
Yes.
From time to, you know, fairly frequently, but I myself just thought it was a whole bunch of, you know. And, you know, my wife and two or three kids at the time, we all went. It was almost a social experience.
Yeah.
They had different events. But, I really didn't believe in it.
Well, that's a funny story, though. You forgot your mantra, and they wouldn't tell you what it was. If you forget it, you've lost it. That's kind of harsh. But Jeff Gilpin, speak to this for a moment. I think in the course of your life, you've had more and less intense times of engagement with the TM movement. Some people, you know, came in. Many, I'm sure, drifted away. What's your sense of what either made it lasting and important for some people or made it, you know, disposable and history for others, Jeff?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. It certainly varies by individuals. A lot of people learned TM and loved it. They wanted to join Maharishi and find out what else he had to offer. A lot of people, you know, learned TM and they just didn't do anything for them. They maybe gave it a go for a few weeks or months and then quit. Some of them went on to other things, and other people didn't. For myself, I was definitely one of the curious. I wanted to go on and find out what else was part of Maharishi's program. And I devoted 5 years to it in the mid-1970s, and it's really been a part of my life ever since.
You know, the Beatles, we quoted Paul McCartney saying that they thought he was more than human and learned that he wasn't finally. Did you have a time of disillusionment, or have you sort of moved beyond that sort of expectation of, divinity or something like it?
Well, I had my own disillusion. It didn't have anything to do with Maharishi personally, though. I did not go in thinking that he was some sort of god or something more than human. And I think that anyone who does join a spiritual organization or approach a teacher with that kind of expectation is not only going to be disappointed, but potentially set up for a real fall. And you know, maybe along with the rest of Maharishi's legacy, maybe he taught us that lesson, that maybe not only are we more interested in the spiritual life now, but maybe we're better spiritual consumers, too, that maybe we know enough now, if we're interested in a guru, a teacher, an organization, to do the research before we get involved. So that's part of his legacy, too.
Mark Jurgensmeyer, what about the way the language of this whole realm of spirituality, meditation, practice, and all the rest has seeped into the wider American culture? Do you find it sort of floating all over the place these days?
Yeah, and it goes both ways, because this and just listening to the Maharishi a second ago, the kind of science that he was talking about, I mean, after all, he studied physics in college, so he tried to incorporate science into the practice and create a religion that was sensible to the modern world, not just because it tapped into ancient traditions, but because it was resonant with scientific practice and teachings and the idea that, you know, you just don't take it on faith. It's something that you have to experience. You'll know it if it works. This is a very pragmatic religion. It's no surprise that it appeals to the American sensibility because, you know, we don't trust things unless we see how it works and whether it works. So, you know, it's a very kind of modern religiosity in that sense. So it has seeped into Christianity. And I was thinking, where has it gone today? And say, well, now the evangelical Christians have, replaced all of this stuff. But, you know, in another sense, the whole evangelical movement is another form of this same kind of religiosity. And funny kind of way, I think the Maharishi and TM and Nichiren and all of the other movements that were popular in the 70s and 80s have kind of laid the ground for a new kind of democratic or popularist religion that doesn't take on faith, the old authority, but, you know, you have to believe in it, you have to really feel it in your life, it has to make a difference, it has to actually change you in a way that's palpable and understandable to the pragmatic American mind.
Yeah, I have to say I've been in evangelical worship services, which were not all that different in many ways,
in
the music and chanting and sort of prayer practice from something pretty Eastern, pretty blissed out. Maharishi said the philosophy of life is this. Life is not a struggle, not a tension. Life is bliss. It is eternal wisdom, eternal existence. Well, it starts to flow into one big ocean there.
Sometimes it goes real fast and other times it goes real slow. Any way you do it, well, it's bound to work, I know.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Transcendental meditation should be part of your time. It's simple, it's easy as making this rhyme.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about the death of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi at what was said to be 91 in the Netherlands, where he had lived in the last years of his life, and looking at America's love affair with Eastern spirituality and meditation from TM to yoga. Jeff Gilpin has joined us from DeForest, Wisconsin. He's author of The Maharishi Effect, a personal journey through the movement that transformed American spirituality. Been in the Maharishi or the TM movement for a long, long time. From Berkeley, California, Mark Jurgensmeyer is with us, director of the Center for Global and International Studies at UC Santa Barbara. We're joined right now from Homesdale, Pennsylvania, by Pandit Rajmani Tiganot. He's a spiritual head of the Himalayan Institute, one of the most prominent centers in the U.S. for the study of yoga, meditation, spirituality, holistic health. He's author of Touched by Fire and Inner Quest, Yoga's Answer to Life's Questions. Pandit Rajmani, Tigunat, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom. I'm here.
We're glad you're here. What do you think of the way Americans have embraced Eastern spirituality and yoga these days? Does it look like it's having a significant impact in this culture to you? How do you see it?
Tom, what TM did and what Maharshi Mahesh Yogiji did here in the West, it has an everlasting impact not only in the United States or Europe, but even in India. I remember in 1970s, I was only 17, 18 years old in the city of Allahabad, mm-hmm. from where Mahesh Yogi comes. Mm-hmm. And his master lived there in Allahabad, Brahmananda Saraswati Ji Maharaj. And when he came with his helicopter, it was such a great thrill, and none of us had heard about Mahesh Yogi Ji, Maharshi Ji, mm-hmm. or we had heard about TM. And it was just a sheer curiosity that pulled more than 50,000 people there, and I was one of them. And then after that, when we found out that he was from Allahabad city, from North India itself, it was kind of mind-boggling, and that's what even made me explore different modalities of meditation, despite the fact that I was very much familiar with the scriptures. But the scriptures had presented meditation and spirituality in a very, mystical manner,
Mm-hmm.
And it is what he did today, if you can see here in the United States, one kind of yoga meditation at one level. But in India, if you go to India and let's say go to Nepal, and you will find amazing things that what is being done by Maharshi's organization in terms of reviving the original wisdom of the Vedas and the Upanishads. And there are hundreds of organizations, and that really is thrilling for both the East and West. And not only that, he popularized yoga, as I have been hearing from so many Professor Dr. Mark Jergensberg, mm-hmm. Meyer, and mm-hmm. And Mr. Jeff.
Mm-hmm.
It's really something that will have its impact more and more and more as the future presents itself. So what we have today here as TM, it looks like it's just the gate, it's like the, as he said, he opened the floodgate here in the United States. After the floodgate is open, what is going to roll after that, that, according to me, has even more impact than what he had in the last 50 years here.
Jeff Gilpin, he was very explicit in saying that if enough people did enough meditation, we'd have world peace. How about it?
That's 100% correct, and in fact, this is one of the things that he really put the ancient wisdom in very modern context, and some of the, and I'm talking from more of the Eastern perspective to address this issue to the Western audience here.
Mm.
In ancient India, there was this group meditation called Akhand Japa. People used to do this kind of meditation for 1 year long meditation around the clock, 3 year long, 12 year long.
He himself went into the Himalayas after his guru Dev died and spent a couple of years there, I think.
Yeah, from 1953 all the way to 55, as we call it, the last years of Maharshi, And that means really that was the most, significant years from his personal standpoint. And, that's what where he gained all that, establishment, sthita pragya, the inner wisdom, and really digested it. And then he brought it back to the world. And that's really true. And that's what the meditation is all about. And what Maharshi has given to the world in a, in such a scientific manner.
Let me put it to Jeff Gilpin. Jeff, we're still kind of waiting for that world peace. In all of your years of association here, how do you look at that now? There were some very large claims made here. I'm not refuting them, but just curious how you look at it. If enough people spend enough time contemplation, meditative contemplation, well, could we have that world peace he was talking about? Do you believe it?
Well, certainly if we're all sitting and meditating, we're not killing each other. I think that the more people who meditate, the better. However, Maharishi's claims really go beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
What we're talking about here are the advanced techniques of meditation that he introduced in the late 1970s after the TM fad ended. He came up with the yogic flying technique.
The Siddhi, if I've got that correctly.
I'm sorry?
How do you pronounce that? Was it the Siddhi program?
The Siddhis, yes. Mm-hmm. Siddhi is a Sanskrit word that means yogic powers or abilities. Supposedly, if you take his Siddhi course, you will learn to levitate. You can walk through walls and become invisible and things like that. And for me, that was a big departure from the simple, practical, pragmatic, grassroots spirituality that he taught in the early days.
Did he stick with that or back off it later when people hurt their noses trying to walk through walls?
Well, you know, the yogic flying technique was not a success with the public the way TM had been, but he continued to promote it, and frankly, his projects, his claims got more and more grandiose, and I would say personally more and more questionable.
Such as?
Well, he does claim that if enough people are practicing yogic flying in one place, that it can influence the stock market, that the stock market will go up and down, the weather will improve, crime ends, war ends, and things like
that. He had a plan to raise $1 trillion and buy 20% of the planet's surface, as I...
Yeah, well, you know, towards the end of his life, he remade his organization as a country, the Maharishi Global Country of World Peace, and he didn't have any territory. So one thing he did was try to buy one-fifth of the Earth's surface to be territory for his country, and that never happened, perhaps fortunately.
Well, not all visions work out, but at the heart of this, we've got something a lot of people are still riding on. Let's go to Holly in Dedham, Massachusetts. Hi, Holly. You're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, I just wanted to share with you the story of my father, who's a physician in his 80s, and during the time that he first was introduced to meditation, he was still backing Nixon in Vietnam, mm-hmm. and he began to become really involved in it as a physician and would often recommend it to his patients for controlling high blood pressure and other aspects of stress disease. Mm-hmm. And currently he is teaching a course for interdenominational groups on what the brain looks like when it does meditate and how the thalamus stays active while the rest of the brain pretty much shuts down, gets quiet.
Holly, have you followed in your father's footsteps on the meditation front?
Well, I have. And in fact, I bring it with me to my Episcopalian church going and traffic jams and all sorts of other aspects of life.
And how does it fit together with your Episcopalian church going? Are you meditating in the pew while the sermon goes on?
Absolutely.
Is that okay or is that cheating?
I think it's part of the feeling of prayer. I think it's at the basic origin of what everyone tries to do is they try to become more attuned to the spiritual aspects.
Holly, thank you very much for sharing that with us. Pandit Rajmani Tugunat, what do you see most Americans looking for when they come into your yoga realm?
What they are looking for, Tom, is a way of acquiring a clear, calm, and tranquil mind. And that's what meditation is all about. And as long as they receive that, they are quite comfortable with meditation. And when, as you had been making these comments about Siddhis and the yogic way of flying, people are still waiting for more kind of direct experience. What everybody really wishes to see or achieve is a clear, calm, and tranquil mind, focused mind, concentrated mind, and that's what people look from, you know, yoga and meditation. And unfortunately, today's current yoga, which has been reduced to asana, the postures and exercises, that kind of yoga is not really delivering that goal and objective. And as long as this goal is delivered, people are very happy with meditation. People are very happy with yoga.
Mark Juergensmeyer, how about it? Yoga studios, I mean, in some places they seem almost like the heir to disco aerobics.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't mean to be too flippant, but you know what I mean. And Pandit says, well, we're missing something sometimes there.
Well, that may be true, but that's, of course, a great deal of part of the appeal of the Maharishi's program, that it can be done by everybody, everywhere. in just a few minutes. You don't have to, you know, renounce your whole life. You just renounce a few minutes now and then. It's a packaged spirituality, and it seems to be enormously appealing. But of course, in that packaging becomes a certain reduction of what other people who are on a more intensive faith path experience see as kind of trivializing religiosity and the religious experience. So it's no wonder that it would be criticized by people both within the Hindu tradition and by, you know, true believing Christians as well.
Let's take a call from Sandy in Appling, Georgia. Hi, Sandy. You're on the air.
Hello. I very much enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Try to listen as often as I can.
Thank you so much.
I am 64 years old, so you know what my generation is.
Yep, we've got your number.
The thing I wanted to say is, I know you're revisiting this topic. You had a book author on a while ago who wrote about the Beatles and their attraction to the Maharishi.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, Beatles was B-E-A-T-L-E-S.
As in the Beats, yep.
As in the Beats. And, of course, as we all know, the Beats were very into Zen and different kinds of Buddhism. So I'd like to put that in first. And the Beatles were started by John Lennon. When he left the Maharishi, he went right over to Janoff and the primal scream therapy. But the reason he left was because not just that the Maharishi was human. They were being very generous when they talked like that. He was a sexual predator, and he was taking advantage of his youngest female followers. And that's the reason that John left the Maharishi's movement.
Sandy, our time grows short. I've got some tape on that. Jeff Gilpin, let me put it first to you. What about that?
Well, you know, that's a story that is going to dog Maharishi throughout history. And I wasn't there in India with the Beatles and Mia Farrow and the rest of them. I can't say what happened. There are all kinds of stories about that. If your listeners are interested, Mia wrote her own autobiography. John Lennon talked about this with Rolling Stone magazine, and there is an awful lot of material available on the Internet on this topic.
I've got a little bit of tape here in the director's cut of the Beatles anthology. Paul McCartney expressed some doubt that the Maharishi ever made a pass at a young woman in their entourage.
I don't personally think he ever did make a pass. He didn't seem like the kind of guy who would. I've since thought, how would he do it? Ooh, you know, excuse me. How would a Maharishi go about making a pass? It's just not so easy. Anyway, so I don't think any of that happened.
Well, there's Paul's view anyway. Here's Mark in Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Mark. You're on the air. Hello, Mark.
Hello there. How are you?
Very well. What do you know?
I was at the ashram once in Rishikesh and got kicked out. I had kind of accidentally stumbled across it in my kayak. I needed to pull off the river because of a rapid. And so I pulled off on the beach there, and a security guard kind of came and kicked me out, and I got back in my boat and left.
That's one way to be introduced to the world of the Maharishi.
Later, when I got back to the village, I asked, what's the deal? Because folks over there usually are really polite and don't ever kick anybody off anything. And they explained to me that the ashram was off limits to foreigners, because the Maharishi had not been paying his taxes in India.
A kayaker's guide to the boundaries of the Maharishi's world in Rishikesh. Mark, thanks for that. Let's hear once more from the man himself. Here, 1969 with the BBC, is the Maharishi talking with Leslie Smith again about the effect of bliss consciousness.
It creates a very happy, jolly mood.
The sort of happy, jolly mood that people claim to get from a bottle of whiskey.
And then the after effects of whiskey are disastrous, but the after effects of meditation are much more encouraging, because one comes out with a happy mood, and then he enjoys the world better and behaves much better.
Much better than whiskey. Mark Jurgensmeyer, do you expect to see in the years ahead a further braiding of spiritual traditions as globalization rolls on? Are we going to see these more and more sort of mixed?
Yeah, I think both things will happen because in addition to being transcendental, the movement was also transnational. So in the very image of the Maharishi was this notion that one was stepping outside of one's own cultural limitations, one's own national cultural boundaries and reaching out to something larger and deeper. And no wonder that the images of peace, both propagated by the Maharishi's own vision and those and the desires of his followers, were very much a part of the movement. That somehow we are getting away from all the little differences that divide us and moving to something that's bigger and grander. And Lord help us, I hope that's going to always be with us in one form or the other.
Well, his passing gives us a moment to, meditate on just how much the integration has happened in the years since it all burst upon us. Mark Juergensmeyer at UC Santa Barbara, it's been great having you. Thank you so very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
And Pandit Rajmani Tigunot, joining us from Honesdale, Pennsylvania, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Jeff Gilpin, author of The Maharishi Effect, thanks for joining us, Jeff.
Thanks, Tom. I had a great time.
Here's the Beatles song, Across the Universe. Jai Guru Deva Om roughly translates, Salutations to the Guru. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Nothing's gonna change my world. Nothing's gonna change my world. Nothing's gonna change my world.